we have transmitted legislation for Medicaid expansion, Medicaid reform.
Governor Bill Walker introduces his own legislation. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, visas for seafood workers are back on track.
There's probably only about 100 of them that we're bringing over, but it's crucial employees.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast is open for business with courses in accounting, human resources, and public administration. Degree programs and courses available online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
After failing to expand Medicaid through a budget item, Governor Bill Walker is trying again. Today, he introduced a standalone bill that would allow the state to accept federal funding for Medicaid expansion while also offering some reform measures. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
When he was campaigning for governor, Bill Walker aggressively stumped on the issue of Medicaid expansion.
There was never a time that we didn't bring this up that there wasn't instantaneous applause.
Now that Walker is in office, getting the state to accept nearly $150 million in federal funds to grow the pool of Medicaid recipients has been one of his top priorities. First, he tried to secure the money through a line in the operating budget, but a House Finance Subcommittee stripped that out. Then he said the legislature should consider an expansion bill by the House Democratic minority. That didn't move. Next, he collaborated with a Republican senator on a reform bill, but the product offered did not include expansion. Now, Walker is doing something that legislators have requested of him since the beginning of session.
We have transmitted legislation for Medicaid expansion, Medicaid reform.
Walker made the announcement in the Capitol's cabinet room with 24 supporters of Medicaid expansion behind him. Right now, the state's Medicaid program mostly covers low-income children and pregnant women. The 9-page bill makes it so that Alaskans with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty level, or about $20,000 a year for a single adult, can get coverage too. There are over 40,000 Alaskans eligible for Medicaid expansion, with some covered by Indian Health Services, but others falling into a gap where they are required to get health insurance by law, but ineligible for subsidies because they don't make enough money. The federal government would pay the total cost of expansion in the first year and then ratchet that down to 90% in the year 2020. But Walker stressed that his bill wasn't just about expansion.
And it is a catalyst for reform. You know, we heard a lot about reform, and we are in the process of reform has been ongoing. We have continued that on. Reform is part of this legislation.
When asked to elaborate on specific reform measures, Walker mostly deferred to his health commissioner and his budget director. Commissioner Valerie Davidson described the promotion of telemedicine to bring costs down, and added that the bill would allow Alaska to apply for waivers to increase the federal match for some health costs. One would allow Indian Health Services beneficiaries to have care from tribal providers totally covered by the federal government.
That allows us to realize a potential savings between $80 to $150 million.
Walker's budget director, Pat Pitney, explained that the bill also starts the process of implementing a provider tax, where up to 6% of medical services can be taxed as revenue for the state.
The provider tax would bring in more than the corporate tax for health providers.
After rolling out the bill, the Walker administration gave the Medicaid supporters the microphone. They were wearing buttons that read, "It's the right thing to do," and most came from various health and trade groups. the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Association, the Alaska Mental Health Trust, and the National Education Association's Alaska chapter were all represented, and they talked about the good expansion would do for their organizations and the people they serve. But there were two people in attendance who would directly benefit from Medicaid. Stephen Grunstein, a 53-year-old Juneau man, stood at the podium and announced he had a terminal kidney disease and could need dialysis within months. He said he found himself in the healthcare gap and that getting help has been difficult.
You go from one agency to another, to another, to another, and everybody's passing you around like a football.
Grunstein added that it was difficult watching the debate over expansion as someone affected by it.
In politics, things go bad. I've seen too many bills start out with really good intentions, go horribly wrong. Let's try not to let the horribly wrong happen here.
Legislators were still reviewing the bill on Tuesday afternoon. But some key players, like Senator Pete Kelly, a Fairbanks Republican, reacted favorably. Kelly had offered his own reform bill, and he said he was glad to see legislation on the issue from the governor. Kelly said some of the reforms in each could be complementary, but he added that expansion remains a sticking point for him.
We're going to disagree on expansion. That's the big thing.
Kelly said he did not want to add people to a, quote, broken system. Hearings on the governor's Medicaid bill are expected to be held starting next week. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The federal government can once again process H-2B visas, the program that traditionally allows foreign fish row technicians to work in Alaska seafood plants. The visa program was in limbo this month after a court ruling in Florida, but now the judge's decision is on hold until mid-April. Dennis Phelan of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association says that should be enough time to move this summer's visas along. His trade association represents nine companies with about 25 Alaska processing plants. Phelan says Alaska's $100 million fish row industry depends on the H-2B visas.
There's probably only about 100 of them that we're bringing over, but it's crucial employees because they are the representatives on the ground for the folks who are buying the product, in most cases Japanese companies.
H-2B visas are intended for temporary non-farm workers. Among other qualifications, employers have to show they can't fill the positions with U.S. workers. Last year, H-2Bs for Alaska jobs were primarily for row technicians, but several dozen visas also went to bolster the sales force at jewelry stores in Southeast Alaska that cater to cruise ship passengers. Phelan says his association is still trying to get the industry back into the J-1 visa program, which used to allow thousands of foreign students to work in Alaska processing jobs. But J-1 visas are no longer allowed for industrial work. Phelan says Alaska seafood processors now go as far as Florida in search of workers, with mixed results.
I think most of them were close to being fully staffed at the beginning of the year, but one of the other problems with the replacement workers we get is a lot of them simply don't fulfill the contracts.
Critics charge that the visa programs essentially export money and drive down domestic wages. Phelan says he's heard the argument that if companies paid more, they could fill the jobs in Alaska. But Phelan says in the end, the finished product has to compete on the global marketplace. Dallas Seavey was the first musher to arrive in White Mountain this morning. It's the second to last stop along the Iditarod Trail. Teams will take an 8-hour mandatory rest there before they make the final push for Nome. As APRN trail reporter Emily Schwing reports, barring any major drama, it's unlikely Seavey will lose his lead. He could be into Nome by early tomorrow morning.
The church bell in White Mountain signaled Dallas Seavey's arrival.
All right, thank you.
Welcome to White Mountain.
Thanks.
Seavey says he's pleased with his run, but the defending champion isn't quite ready to credit his team with winning this year's Iditarod.
You get so much on the line right now. So on one hand, I'm really excited to get to Nome. Let's just get this thing done with, get it in the bag, have it in the record books, you know. But on the other hand, I don't want this to end. This has been way too much fun with this dog team.
Stevie's been in a chipper mood for most of the race. He says he's never had as much fun driving a dog team, but he also says he's worked for nearly half a decade to raise the kind of team he's driving this year.
I mean, coming in here today, I was just looking at him, just up and down the team, and every single one of those dogs is a superstar. It's just, I feel pretty privileged to be able to run with those guys.
CV has won the Iditarod twice before. His dogs are known for their speed, and he says his mushing style reflects their genetics.
Speed's the name of the game for these guys, and most times I see people get good speed in their team, they don't hold on to it. They use it in the short term, and then they burn it up.
But he doesn't like to run long without giving his dogs some extra rest.
So you get ahead with the speed and then you give it back to them and rest. And that takes confidence in your dog team that they'll get up and go fast again and again and again. So they know if they go fast, I'll give them more rest. And I know that if I give them more rest, they'll keep going fast. So that's, you gotta trust each other.
The final 70-mile run to Nome isn't nearly as long as other runs along the Iditarod Trail, and CV's unlikely to lose his lead, but the Bering Sea Coast is known for dramatic changes in weather, and dog teams have also been known to quit unexpectedly. CV's well aware that the final push to the finish line is sometimes the most dramatic. On the Iditarod Trail, I'm Emily Schwing in White Mountain.
Chasing Dallas is his dad, Mitch Seavey, who is about 4 hours behind his son. In third place currently is Aaron Burmeister, followed by Jesse Royer in fourth and Allie Zirkel in fifth. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskan insurer Primera announces a data hack.
This is data going back to 2002, so this affects current and former members, in addition to other individuals and organizations with whom we may have done business.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
If you have a health insurance plan through Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, your personal information may be vulnerable to a data breach. According to Primera, about 650,000 Alaskans are among the 11 million people potentially affected by a cyber attack of the health insurance company. A Primera press release says attackers may have gained access to customers' names, dates of birth, social security numbers, mailing addresses, and bank account information. Eric Erling is Vice President of Communications at Primera Blue Cross, based in Washington.
This is data going back to 2002, so this affects current and former members, in addition to other individuals and organizations with whom we may have done business.
Erling says Primera is the largest health plan in Alaska. It has about 110,000 current members in the state. The health insurance company discovered the attack at the end of January and notified the FBI, which is now part of the investigation. Primera issued a press release about the cyber attack and notified employers and health brokers today. It also plans on mailing letters to notify everyone potentially affected. Primera is offering 2 years of free credit monitoring and identity theft protection services. Customers can sign up at the website primeraupdate.com. In Nome, onlookers welcomed the first racers off the Iditarod Trail yesterday, but not for the iconic sled dog race. These racers had wheels. KNOM's Francesca Fenzi has more.
J. Peterberry of Victor, Idaho, and Jeff Oatley of Fairbanks were the first to cross the Burled Arch in Nome on Monday. But not for the race that you think. Once called the Iditasport Impossible, the rebranded Iditarod Trail Invitational mirrors the 1,000-mile sled dog race of the same name, with one major difference. These racers aren't mushing a team of dogs. They're running, skiing, or cycling across the finish line. And in some ways, manpower appears to have bested dog power on the trail. The lack of snow and icy trail conditions that made the southern race route impassable for dog teams this year actually benefited those tackling the trail on wheels. Cyclist John Lackey of Anchorage reached the halfway point in McGrath just 1 day, 18 hours and 32 minutes into the race, a time 4 hours faster than the leading dog team on record. Oatley himself holds the current cycling record for the full course an astonishing 10 days, 2 hours, and 53 minutes set in 2014. For comparison, if he'd been mushing a team of dogs, Oatley would have placed 21st in last year's Iditarod race.
You know, I just got lucky with that. That's what it takes to do that kind of time, more than anything. But this is the race that I wanted. I didn't want to do a time trial to Nome last year. I wanted to go out and ride the Iditarod Trail, and this year we got that. I was a little bummed for the first 300 miles. I was like, you know, this used to be a winter race. But then I lived to regret saying that out loud.
Indeed, Oatley and Peterberry ran into more than their share of winter after the halfway point. Peterberry says the real weather kicked in just as the pair was leaving Takotna.
The trail just deteriorated from there, and speeds were slowing, and then it just dropped to negative 40 for about 6 nights straight. And this is about the warmest day we've had since then.
After a grueling 15 days, 6 hours, and 29 minutes on the trail, Oatley and Peterberry pedaled under the Burled Arch just seconds apart. So perfectly in sync that even their fans couldn't spot the winner. When pressed about who actually won, Oatley points to his friend and competitor.
Jay did.
Everyone who comes underneath this arch actually wins in the end.
Peterberry adds that much like with the 1,000-mile sled dog race, arrival in Nome is never guaranteed. Since the Invitational started in 2000, only 52 individuals have ever made it across the finish line, 34 of them on bikes. Sharing a hug and a toast over their two-wheeled sleds, the two cyclists have little difficulty pinpointing their favorite moment on the trail.
This one. This was pretty cool because last year I rode in and Phil's wife was here and my wife was here and that was it. And it's like, here's a Coke, which is great. I really wanted a Coke, but this is better.
Reporting under the Burled Arch in Nome, I'm Francesca Fenzi.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game says the Sitka Sound Sack Row herring fishery will be on 2-hour notice starting 10 a.m. tomorrow. A test sample taken from a body of herring west of Black Rock showed about 7% mature roe, which is low for the commercial fishery. But the department said that percentage could rise rapidly over the next few days as less mature herring separate out from those ready to spawn. Fish and Game also conducted an aerial survey of Sitka Sound Monday and reported herring predators concentrated in the areas west and south of Crow Island and Biley Rock. This year's fishery is being conducted as a co-op in response to historically low prices for herring. As a result, Sitka is expecting a much smaller fleet than in recent years. Despite having no quorum and no vote, tribal members at the Chilista-sponsored Yukon-Kuskokwim Governance Convention yesterday decided to move ahead with an interim step toward unifying the region politically. Leaders put the future of a proposed regional tribal government first in the hands of tribal councils and set a deadline of 30 days for a vote. If successful, the proposal would then go before individual tribal voters who would be able to vote yes or no. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
The group never formally convened due to only 24 of the required 29 delegates showing up due to travel issues. There was no quorum, which is required for a vote according to rules set up for the convention. However, a vigorous debate did ensue on the merits of a new constitutional government and the many variations of what it could look like. Chilista Board Chair Willie Casile is the regional committee chair and called the day historic.
It was a consensus because of lack of quorum and based on a lot of comments that we were hearing from the participants that they want to come out of this meeting with something to report back to their villages.
Once a packet of information goes out to tribal councils, the clock starts ticking on a 30-day period in which leaders want the tribes to vote on whether to put a vote to the people on creating a new tribal government or reforming the nonprofit, the Association of Village Council Presidents, or AVCP. The convention grew out of the regional committee, which was formed by the Chilista Board in late 2013. Chilista is the corporation formed under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act on behalf of Alaska Native people in the YK Delta region. Monday's agenda originally included a vote by delegates on whether to send the issue to individual voters and appoint a final constitutional drafting team. For Nastasha Levi of Lower Kalskag, it was all moving too quickly. She said a lot of people don't understand what's being proposed. Her tribe has passed a resolution opposing a new tribal government.
This is kind of like missing lots of steps, you know, we're overstepping lots of mini steps that we should be doing before we go jump into a regional tribal government.
Robert Porter is the former president of the Seneca Nation in New York and a tribal law expert who fielded the bulk of the questions at the convention. He emphasized that a government structure elevates tribal leaders when they work to effect change.
And it puts you on par with the state and federal governments in terms of your ability to engage with government-to-government dialogue. It gives you new arguments, new powers to be able to say on behalf of the people, the region, the resources, you know, we're the government here, and it's the government policy about how we're going to move forward, say, to protect subsistence.
The scope of a new tribal government is still nebulous, and the path to federal recognition is as uncertain. A discussion draft 12-page constitution lays out a regional tribal government complete with three branches of government, power for law enforcement, and fish and game management. The resolution looks at capturing income taxes from Native corporations and assessing taxes on regional lands and businesses. The prospects of taxing the Donlin Gold Project and capturing revenues from offshore oil came up several times Monday, although there are major legal hurdles in front of both. Gloria Simeon is the president of ONC Bethel's tribe. She urged baby steps and reiterated that the region's tribes are already sovereigns.
As a tribal nation, government to government, we expect federal agencies to come and talk to us, nation to nation, government to government. We can do no less for our tribal members. Every tribe, every tribal council needs to have this information and vote. Not delegates, no. The vote needs to come from the people.
Trelista says the steering committee will compile information to send out to tribes prior to their vote. No future meeting dates are set. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The 2015 PFD filing season is here. If you have questions about your absences or someone you know away at college or serving in the military, the State of Alaska Department of Revenue encourages you to be proactive. Check out the absence guidelines before applying for your PFD. Visit pfd.alaska.gov and click on eligibility in the banner to learn more. The deadline to apply is March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Prince Rupert leaders are in Juneau this week to lobby for continued connections with Southeast Alaska. Budget cuts threaten to reduce state ferry sailings to and from the British Columbia port city, and policy differences have blocked construction of a new ferry terminal there. Rupert Mayor Lee Brain says the Marine Highway Link helps economies on both sides of the border.
We see Prince Rupert as Canada's gateway to Alaska, you know. This is the quickest way to get to Alaska. Most people don't want to drive through the Yukon up to Alaska. And so we see this as a very important economic and partnership opportunity to continue on with this link.
The Rupert delegation is meeting with Governor Bill Walker and the House and Senate Transportation Committees. The University of Alaska Fairbanks fell just short of a national title at the NCAA Rifle Championships on their home turf over the weekend. For the second year running, the Nanooks placed second to West Virginia University. The margin of victory was just two shots, with UAF taking Friday's small bore match at the Patty Center and the Mountaineers coming back on Saturday with just enough in the air rifle competition to nab the overall title in the eight-team competition. West Virginia's Marin Prediger was the top individual shooter. UAF's Tim Sherry was best Nanook in eighth place. Chilly winds and whiteout conditions didn't stop a team of emergency responders from mounting a unique exercise at the port of Dutch Harbor on Friday. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal was there and has the story.
It was almost impossible to make out the Coast Guard cutter Monroe as it sat it on Alaska's municipal dock on Friday afternoon. The white ship disappeared behind blowing snow, but a line of red SUVs and ambulances from Unalaska's fire department stuck out like a sore thumb. They were waiting for an off-duty police officer to open fire. Clad in a camouflage jacket and beanie, Officer Kyle Haskins strode toward the dock and began firing blank ammunition into the air. On cue, a handful of Coast Guard personnel lined up in front of the ship fell to the ground. They were the casualties in this mass shooting drill.
Where's my arm?
It's right next to you.
Where?
Do you have
Lieutenant Junior Grade Garrett Wright played the role of an amputee as personnel from the cutter's battle dress station tended to his wounds. Richard Martin is a part of that medical crew.
So we go to any scene that we can possibly save the personnel, we remove them. But we assess also on seeing that, you know, if we can save them or not.
Martin watched as Unalaska's emergency medical responders swooped in and started affixing tags to victims, sorting out who was deceased, who was alive but badly hurt.
Yeah, exit one.
Okay.
It has not been treated, right?
No, just the patch.
The patients were transported in ambulances for further care. It took some work to figure out how Unalaska's small fleet could be stretched to accommodate those patients and how to coordinate the cutter's crisis response with local police. Radio calls flew back and forth.
From Cutter Monroe, this is a drill. Active shooter has been identified as a white male, 6 feet tall, wearing tan pants, a black hat, camouflage jacket, wearing gloves, carrying a long gun. Over.
Communication was a big component of the exercise. The Monroe is required to go through mass shooting drills, but they haven't always focused on working with local law enforcement. And Richard Martin says the cutter's last exercise in Kodiak also didn't involve as much planning.
Yeah, it was kind of one of those things that just happened, and it was like, what do we do? But obviously we're a lot better this time.
The shooter was disabled by a local police officer. Response times were fast, and communication was pretty smooth, even when things got tense. Alejandro Bong Tungle is a manager for North Pacific Fuel. They have a contract to fill up the Coast Guard's cutters, and Tungle agreed to play along.
So while fueling, I heard 4 shots. So I ran next to the landing craft on the little cabin in there and hide in there.
Coast Guard personnel couldn't take any chances. When they found Tungle had run aboard the ship, they put the fuel manager in handcuffs.
About 30 minutes on my stomach, laying down, on my stomach.
While they figured out who he was and whether he had anything to do with the attack on the port. Once Tungle was released, crews at North Pacific Fuel and other facilities nearby started practicing their lockdown procedures. Those marine support businesses wanted to be a part of the exercise. And as with most activities in Unalaska, they weren't about to hold for weather. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing on the Iditarod Trail, Lisa Fu and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, Francesca Fenzi in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The University of Alaska Southeast has programs in business, arts and sciences, education, and career education. UAS is a learning community where your professors are mentors and friends on campus and online. uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. The American Lung Association of Alaska invites you to join their premier annual cycling event, the Clean Air Challenge, on May 9th. This family-friendly one-day event begins in Talkeetna and offers routes ranging from 10 to 100 miles. This fundraiser benefits the American Lung Association to support lung health programs across Alaska. For more information, visit cleanairchallengeak.org.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.